The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today is Lania Gandhi. Lania is the managing director of TGG Group, a consulting firm founded by leading economists and psychologists to help companies integrate insights from behavioral science into their everyday decision-making. She teaches at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, where she works with the esteemed economist Richard Thaler. She went to Harvard, but more importantly, she took improv classes at Second City and a number of other fantastic improv schools in Chicago. Lania Gandhi, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you, Kelly.
Okay, so I don't know how many of our listeners would be familiar with your company, TGG Group, but let me list three of your founding partners. All right, we're going to start there. Daniel Kahneman, who is the 2002 Nobel Prize winner and the author of Thinking Fast and Slow. Stephen Levitt, the author of Freakonomics, who is also awarded the John Bates Clark Medal for the most influential economist under the age of 40. And the late Gary Becker, who won the Nobel Prize in 1992. So would it be accurate to say that your company is kind of like the Avengers if the Avengers were all scientists whose chief superpower is insight?
Yes.
That is exactly correct.
Yeah, that's pretty much day in the life.
I've nailed it.
Nailed it.
So how beyond the Avengers, which I think you can use now, I'll let you.
Yeah, copyrighted.
Yeah, go for it. How else would you describe the company to a layperson walking down the street who says, what do you do?
Yeah, so I think it depends on their reference set.
Yep.
If I already know what they do, then I try to make a reference to what they actually do and how we might help. But the generic version is we take insights and findings from academics, things that are locked up in the ivory tower that people don't really read every day, from cognitive psychology, social psychology, and economics. And we bring them to bear on real problems happening in businesses today, often within the businesses themselves. So what kind of processes and decisions employees themselves are going through? How can we make those easier, faster, better, less biased to steal from the psychology?
Right. And what I find really interesting about what you do is that you don't just traffic in data.
Right.
And you don't just traffic in behavioral science. You kind of build understanding with both areas. And that seems to me to be unusual and really, really cool.
Exactly. It's the marriage between data science and behavioral science that I think really brings value to our clients.
Yeah. And, you know, when you go on the website, too, and I know you studied with Richard Thaler, who, by the way, is probably best known as the co-author of Nudge. And you guys might have seen him on The Big Short in that film where he describes certain economic.
A hot hand.
Yeah, right.
Of course,
right.
He worked in sports. He's a big sports fan.
Yep. And your company uses his theories of choice architecture.
Yes.
Can you explain what choice architecture is?
So choice architecture is a concept that really encompasses every choice that may be out there today, whether you're a parent, a business person, you and I talking together right now.
Yeah.
The choices that we make, let's say we're a very classic example, sitting down at a restaurant looking at a menu. How are the different options on that menu presented? How are they described? Where is the price placed? Mind you, it doesn't even matter what the price is. It's about the presentation of those options. What's the music that's playing in the background? How are we greeted? The entire environment or architecture around the choice we're about to make makes a great deal of difference in what we end up choosing, particularly in situations where we don't have very grounded certain choices. Does that make sense?
It does. This is what I flash on. My wife and I were having a discussion of why Tony and Tina's wedding was successful. And her theory was that people knew how to dress because it was for a wedding. And one of the things that I thought was so true about that is people don't know how to dress for theater. And I think it's one of the reasons people don't always go to theater.
Yeah, exactly. If you can, you make, so if they're deciding where to go for the evening and spending, there's all these alternatives. You can go to a restaurant, you can go to the theater, you can go to a dance, you can go for a walk in the park. You might choose the one that's easiest if you're generally indifferent across them.
Right.
And maybe not knowing a clear rule on what to follow in terms of dress code could inhibit you making that choice.
Right. And I think what most people choose is to actually not do anything.
Yes, which inertia.
And that's the default behavior,
exactly.
Right? The number one.
Defaults are very strong, which is why when my husband and I don't know what to do for the evening, we end up sitting on the couch.
Right, right. So, all right. So one thing that also is fascinating about the discussions of choice architecture, and I have been in lectures and read books and listened to podcasts, and it almost always leads with an ethical discussion.
Yes.
You laugh, and it is. It's funny because that is the, it's fronted up huge.
And it's tough.
Right.
I mean, ethics is different to everybody. That's mm-hmm. the problem. You're talking about utility, if you want to go to the economic language of this. But what utility matters? Whose utility matters? If I'm a government or if I'm a company setting the policy for retirement for my employees, what utility matters? Is it how these employees are going to feel 20 years later? Am I helping them pick the right savings choice? Is it how they feel now, cash constrained, wanting to have more take home, or mental capacity constrained, not having time to think about this? Whose utility matters? Theirs, my own, their current one, their retrospective one later.
Right. Because very specifically, you could choice architect it so that the company saves money.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You could also choice architect it so that the default, which is a very powerful nudge, is that they save a lot.
Yeah.
But that's not always right for everybody. Mm-hmm. Eric Johnson, who's a professor at Columbia, just gave a great talk on choice architecture a week ago at the BSPA conference in D.C. And he pointed out that a lot of these nudges that are becoming popularized, like saving for retirement, are all about a mean shift.
Hmm.
So we want everybody to save more. We want to shift that distribution of savings over in one direction. But that's not necessarily the right answer, particularly for people, employees who might be older. Men generally mm-hmm. don't live as long as women.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to nudge men to save a different amount. Or his example, actually, now that I think about it, was not saving for retirement, but when to make those withdrawals from Social Security.
Right.
So if my genetics are such that I'm not going to live as long, maybe I should just start withdrawing at the earliest age of 62. But if I'm going to live a long time, I want to withdraw longer. So you have to be more nuanced in the way you think about these things, or else you actually could end up doing something unethical.
Right. And so the improv shift here for mm-hmm. me is when I think about any improv game that involves a new choice. So you think of a game like Take That Back, and that's a game where, and you guys might have seen it on Whose Line Is It Anyway or at Second City, where a bell is rung and the last thing someone said they have to replace
yeah.
with a new thing. And what that is modeling choice architecture to my mind, because you're going to see what the results are each time when it's different, and it's radically different just with a word change.
Mm-hmm. And I think your analogy is really apt, and I'm thinking of something I learned from Susan Messing, which was just change your spine to start a scene.
Hmm.
That's really, it's my same spine, it's my same body. Nothing real is changing around me. I'm just shifting the presentation of it, and that can inform so much about how I feel and how I interact. Just a small change like that.
Yeah, Susan is a Second City alum and a noted improv teacher at the Annoyance Theater and elsewhere. Yeah, she's great. Okay, so I want to talk a bit about noise.
Sure.
That's one of the areas of study for you, and another word, I guess, is random variability. So is this when different people in the same situation make completely different judgments? Is that what we're talking about?
Generally.
What else? What is noise in your context?
So let's take the example of recruiting.
Yeah.
You and I see the exact same person and exact same information about them and make wildly different decisions on whether we want to hire that person or not.
Right.
And ideally, if you're all looking at the same role to be filled, you and I should be interchangeable from the organization standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone looking at loans, for instance. If I see an application for a loan come into my bank, I and you, if we're different loan officers, ought to make generally the same decision on whether or not to accept that loan and at what terms. If we're wildly varied, then that's going to cost the organization money and even be unfair to those people coming to interact with our organization.
Why would we be wildly varied?
Yeah, so this brings up another idea, which is bias.
Yeah.
So at the individual level, you and I may have different degrees of bias,
sure.
or different types of bias that when you add our decisions up at the organizational level looks like noise and random variation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of different ways of thinking about bias. You and I could share the same bias, so we could see loan applications and both be wildly optimistic and shift in the same direction. We could look at this, maybe when you see a certain type of loan, let's say from someone from a certain geography, every time you see that type of loan, I don't know, someone from the South, maybe you have some sort of assumption about people from the South, and so you're more pessimistic about them when you look at their loans.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a case-specific bias. When you, it's, you know, stereotyping discrimination is a version
sure.
of case-specific. And then you could have a bias that has to do with the rater. So maybe we both interact that way in this with respect to looking at someone from the South or some type of discrimination. But if we have it to different degrees, that's more rater specific.
So how did the, so yes, playing out in money, I can certainly see that. If that goes into health, like how does that, like a radiologist or someone else in a healthcare situation, does noise come in? Is it factored into that world as well?
Yeah, there's some really interesting studies done in that field. I'm trying to think of a good one to share. There's one that could happen, but this is more bias than noise.
Right.
I've seen there's a great excellent study where you're shown two different pills for the same therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Let's say it's hypertension.
Right.
And pill A and pill B have generally the same efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
When you present to you and me two different doctors and you show us A, the absolute mortality rates, though, if this could kill someone, versus the absolute survivability rates, so just the flip of that number,
right,
versus the relative mortality rates, you have very different views on whether you should choose A versus B. So people are pretty indifferent when you look at survivability. So 96% of people survive with A, 98% survive with B. Feels the same, right?
Yep.
Now, if we were shown that 6% die with B and 4% survive with A, I might be more inclined
right.
to avoid the death one because
totally.
It was framed that way.
Yeah.
Now, if I tell you that one pill has it reduces the mortality rate by a third,
mm-hmm.
we're definitely going to pick that one. So you see people shift from being about indifferent to 90% of them choosing one over the other. So that's a bias because it happens for everybody.
Right.
Now, if we were to different degrees susceptible to that based on something random like the weather or our personality, that would be noise.
Right. Okay. So
it's
framing, right? So that's the other thing. I remember when I get interviewed about the theater industry in general, and I'd say all theater is context. You know that the people who are successful have an understanding of how to present their work in a certain way. And what I meant was framing. I just didn't know that word in this context, and I find that completely fascinating because none of the real stuff has changed. You know, I mean, we're not
exactly.
talking about like, yeah, you know, if it's a piece of fish, we're not saying like it's a completely different piece of fish. It's just how you have framed that experience of buying all the way through. And that seems so. Is that in vogue now, or is that still something that you're having to convince potential clients is important?
I think showing studies like that pill one, which were done with actual medical students.
Yeah.
Are quite convincing. Studies done with judges on noise and bias. I mean, there's a classic one with judges in Israel where you look at, I believe it was their parole mm-hmm. decisions, and they are much more lenient after lunch and after their snack.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, those, I think, are quite persuasive. I think it's harder to make the case when I'm saying, Kelly, you and your colleagues might be susceptible to noise and bias.
Right.
It's harder when it's
yeah
to make that direct leap unless someone's really impacted by these arguments from other domains.
And Kahneman, I think, said that it's easier to control noise than bias.
It is, because you don't actually need to know, in most cases, you don't actually need to know what's accurate. So if you imagine a bunch of targets
mm-hmm.
that you're shooting at,
mm-hmm.
I know this is where you know that the middle point is accurate.
Right.
So if you see a scattering of shots, that's noise. Mm-hmm. If you see shots all to the left, that's bias. Maybe you see shots all to the left but scattered, that's biased and noisy. But if I were to take away that center across those four targets I showed you, you would have no idea whether there was accuracy or not. on even the biased one where it's all to the left because it's all clustered together.
Right.
You would, however, be able to see noise because it's scattered.
Right, right.
Not everyone can be right.
Sure. Wow. Okay. I want to talk about fraud detection.
Okay.
All right. Simply, I mean, there's something, and this was, I don't know if folks have read Freakonomics. You should. It's a great book. And one of the amazing sort of stories in there is how these guys discovered fraud in sumo wrestling, which is just a, you know, a cool, interesting story. But there's this detective aspect that, you know, I love around it. And you know, I was combing through your website and you guys talk about that's one of your services is detecting fraud, correct?
Yes. Yes. All right. That's more on the data analytics side, but with the behavioral bent.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
Oh, so I'm not, I mean, I can speak to it.
You're
but
not in
I'm
the
not,
fraud department?
I'm not in the fraud department. I can speak to it at a high level, but I don't think I'll be as interesting as one of my colleagues who are closer to the data.
Tell us just a little bit about it. How does it work? What do you guys do?
So I think the idea is to look at what data do you, you know what you're trying to find. Bad actors, people that are doing things harmful to the organization, like a clear non-ethical action. So how you have to start, you have to think of like that person. Like what might they do that's bad? And then look for proxies of them about to do it or doing it in the data that you have. Does that make sense?
Sure. So you're combing numbers, but combing numbers with context.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's about proxies. I think about the study that Steve did where he was looking for fraud, I believe it was Steve, fraud in teachers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they looked, he thought about, well, what would be easiest? Erasing the last few on everyone, not, you know, randomly doing it. So putting yourself in the head of the bad actor and thinking about what are they're not going to do the hardest thing possible. They're going to do what's easiest and available. So what's that route? And can you find in the data, because generally you're trying to find
this, it's a needle in a haystack.
Right. So you need a large volume.
Right.
What data do you have available and what can it tell you about those little behaviors that are signaling bad actors.
So, yeah, they just looked at the last page.
Yeah,
exactly. Wow. So I've been lucky enough to work in a place for the last 3 decades that has essentially cornered the market on comedy and improvisational talent with really no connection to data whatsoever. The data is not our has never been our friend at the Second City. So how do you guys approach an area like human capital? Because you use data in terms of your research and your study in human capital.
Oh, yeah. So in terms of using data, sometimes you just have to use survey data.
Yeah.
And get a sense of how people feel before and after you've rolled something out. Sometimes you do qualitative interviews and then roll that up into data. But there are proxies you can look at. So within human capital, well, I've got two things come to mind. One is in processes that people have to go through for human capital, such as performance evaluation.
Right.
You can look at their behavior as they interact in that process. How long does it take them to go through something? Do they abandon it and quit out versus stay in? That can really be a good measure for engagement. On the other hand, I'm thinking of a recruiting project where we were looking at a group of people in a financial services firm who were in a collections department. And there was wide differentiation in how the top performers and the bottom performers were doing. And obviously the organization wanted to understand that and maybe recruit better people or coach people to get better.
Sure.
All we did was look at the data on how people were performing and the data that was collected during their recruitment, you know, months or years before, and had it talk to each other, which sounds easy, but it's hard because you need two data systems to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And we found that people who did better on the screening test in recruiting did worse, actually, on the job. And the reason was that when you looked at the actual test they went through, it was testing for empathy, which you would love in a coworker, but not so much in a collections agent. Exactly.
So the thing that got them the gig, because they connected with the human being across them, made them maybe not so good at the gig.
Exactly. Exactly.
Could you imagine having to work in a place where you're looking to hire people without empathy?
Yeah. So the recommendation might not be necessarily to change that, but maybe to add a few other questions in that test that could look at other attributes of that person that, yes, maybe they're empathetic in everyday life, but when put in this role, they'll be able to ask the right questions or pull the right levers.
Well, that's a nice way for you to think about it. I'm sure someone else is thinking about, get me someone who's just cold and harsh. So, wow, that's fascinating. And it's interesting, too, because, again, and let's talk about this, because when you were studying at Booth, you were taking improv classes. Is that right?
Yes, I did them concurrently.
Concurrently. Okay, so you're undergrad? Were you at undergrad? Or no, that was grad?
No, so that was graduate school, okay. Which is when I did my MBA, but also took PhD classes in behavioral science and did the improv on the side. So those two worlds started intersecting for me at that time.
Okay, now, and you didn't know that that would happen.
No.
Okay, so there's no connect point. You just decide you're in the academic world. You're digging what you do, right? And because you're fascinated by the stuff, as I am as well. And then you decide to take an improv class because you wanted to meet someone, or you.
I had done it in high school a little bit back in Milwaukee, and I always enjoyed being on the stage, and wanted a hobby. I needed something to balance out my time, and I knew it made me scared.
Right.
And my rule of thumb lately, as an adult. Has been, if it scares you, do it more, in general. Let's not make a glossy term out of that.
No. But I real quickly, when we created a show with Lyric Opera and Renee Fleming, and the co-host for the show is called The Second City Guide, the opera was Patrick Stewart. And he agreed to improvise, and he had never improvised in his life.
Wow.
And after he did it, and it was really amazing, and he was great at it, we were just sitting around talking, and he said, you know, the reason that I am so happy I did this is because I got scared. And at my age, with my success, I don't get scared anymore. And he has continued to improvise with different people ever since that experience.
That's excellent.
Yeah. It's Del Close has that sort of follow the fear idea. So,
yes.
Yeah. So you did it.
So I did it. And I can't even tell you how much I mean, I'm speaking to the choir here, but
mm-hmm.
What I'm glad about what I did was that I went through a whole slew of courses in a row, mm-hmm. which I think had the philosophy. I really do think of it as a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
A way of life, a lens through which to see the world. That really helped imbue it in me and helped me see it around me and in what I do every day and catch myself not following it when I should.
Hmm. And then you were connecting it to the work that you were studying, though,
mm-hmm.
too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the
trying.
Yeah.
We'll see.
And the reason we even know each other was that sort of fateful day when I found myself in an office of a colleague of yours describing the improv mindset as we see it, and she was filling in the holes from a behavioral science sort of point of view, going, why have these things never been connected? And to our mind, they only have been in very minor instances. But I think what we both see is like, no, behavioral science has taught us that people make a lot of bad decisions for mm-hmm. themselves. And what improvisation essentially is are rules for the road to make better decisions
mm-hmm.
for ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is all about interpersonal.
Mm-hmm.
For me, at least. What I take away from it is, I mean, every day at the office, I could do my job better if I followed the rules of improv.
Yeah.
I don't always follow the rules of improv.
No, none of us do. But again, the improv recognizes that.
Right. And you have to forgive yourself.
Yep. And you've got to make mistakes and you've got to have resilience
mm-hmm.
because we're imperfect beasts.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to do a little game with you.
Sure.
I'm going to read you, I want you to put on your science hat, all right? I'm going to read you like an improv phrase, and I want to see if you can find a connect point into your science world and your science brain.
All right, let's see.
All right, here's one. Try to become a better audience yourself so that you may begin to understand what makes us appreciate a better performance.
Mm. Okay, I'm going to go with what came right to mind.
Yeah.
Which is the attribution bias.
What's that?
And the inability and naive realism. So the latter being around the idea that I think everybody sees the world the same way I do.
Right.
Which is absolutely incorrect.
Yes.
Nick Epley has some fantastic work on this. A whole book came out on it, MindWise.
Mm-hmm.
So for people interested in that. And the idea of the attribution bias is not is maybe a tangential offspring off of that. And it was actually one of my favorite concepts early on, which is if I'm driving the car really fast, it's because I have a reason.
Mm-hmm.
If you're driving the car really fast, you have road rage or you're a terrible person.
Right.
You know, I blame the person when it's someone else. I blame the situation when it's me. So, again, it's about perspective taking.
Yeah, that's perfect. All right, I'm gonna give you one more. And we're not doing a rule of three. We're doing a rule of two. Think of the environment as a multidimensional where of which the audience is a part. The environment also contains an outside or beyond and an inside. Focus in and focus out.
So that, I mean, that's choice architecture.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
And one of the frustrating things about choice architecture, by the way, is that everything is choice architecture.
No, yeah, I know.
Almost.
But when you're talking about a where, right? So this is a big thing in improvisation that you talk about, you know, what's your where and defining where. And this idea of a multidimensional where that, can, you know, to quote Whitman, contains multitudes, right?
Yes.
You know, and great improvisers, TJ and Dave, Susan Messing, the different people, Mick Napier that we've talked about, are continuing to make incredible discoveries inside what may seem like the most banal choice.
The answer is right in front of you.
Yeah.
It's always in front of you.
Right. And improvisation makes you practice that over and over because you don't believe it in first class. You can't. I don't think anyone entering their first class could believe how deep this stuff goes.
No.
Yeah, it's really interesting. All right, we're coming close to the end. I can't believe it. This moves so quickly. But I want to ask you, we talked a little bit on the phone, and we started talking about pharma and pricing and fairness in pharma. And I'm sort of fascinated by the subject in general.
Yes.
Especially, you know, for all of us when we heard about, like, Pharma Bro and this price gouging. So you guys do a little bit of work in that area, right?
Yeah, we work across industries. And pricing is certainly something that we've worked on from a pure econometric standpoint in other industries, but as well as from a fairness standpoint.
Yeah.
You have to understand the importance of presentation in pricing, particularly when your intentions are good, because it's very easy to mess up.
Right.
In an industry in healthcare, when price increases are always over the front page of the news, and it's very harmful for society, many would argue, it's important for that industry to be especially aware of the issues of fairness, both actually in actuality. So those are healthcare consultants. That's not my area. But also in terms of perception. So one of the findings in fairness in general is if you're raising prices because your costs are going up, people tend to find that okay. Like that makes sense to a point.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the studies are done with snow shovels. That's very different than an extremely expensive life-saving drug. So there's only so much that you can extrapolate. But if you're raising price to just grab margin because you think, for instance, when some of these companies have acquired drugs and then jacked the prices up because they thought it was under market, that certainly seems unfair to people because there's no underlying cost issue. There's no underlying reason besides grabbing surplus.
So what's your job in this scenario, your company? What are you doing? Are you using data to explain?
I mean, when we can, but I think data on that is few and far between.
Right.
I think it's about, and this is not just in pricing or in pharma, in any project where I'm leveraging behavioral insights, I have a responsibility to educate people, and I have a responsibility to educate them about their responsibilities in using that material.
Right.
Whether or not they follow through with it is unfortunately not something that I can control. I've been very fortunate to work with clients who I believe are very aware and very well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I always have, I don't want to say a red flag, I always have glasses on of what is the worst way I can misinterpret this information, and am I doing everything in my power and in my team's power to make sure that people on the other side understand that, and I'm also making an economic argument for it, because sometimes their bosses or their colleagues may only listen to that. And that's where I think the fairness studies come in.
Yeah, it's also ethics again.
Yeah, it's a very hairy. I think that's something that our field of applied behavioral science, not just my firm, but those doing it in government and other firms, are going to increasingly encounter, because this work is becoming more and more prevalent in the private sector.
It was funny. We were in England on taking some meetings, and we met with Alain Botton. Do you know his work? He runs a place over there called the School of Life, and he's sort of a noted he's a psychologist, and he does a lot of TV. He's very charismatic. And he was talking about in ancient society, There was always a house priest for the ruling family. And if you think about a sort of a modern correlation, I mean, these ruling families are essentially like a lot of the military-industrial complex that, you know, that runs everything for us. But these family priests would advise. They weren't there just to do communions because there weren't that many. They were there to also take the temperature of the people in the village and communicate that back. And in fact, they were HR. but with an ethical bent.
Right.
And certainly, you know, that and I, that's a struggle, right? Because I don't, you know, a lot of HR is making sure the paperwork's, you
right.
know, in order. And you can think about a very modern way to perhaps think about HR is to have an ethicist in that office for
yes.
everyone's good.
Yeah, and I think the danger. Well, if I'm a private sector company, then they think, well, what ethics should it be? And how will that be viewed? And I think it's a bit about taking a bold stance of what the ethics is.
Right, because this isn't just a top-down.
Rather than just keeping specificity, right?
Yes, very important.
Don't let it stay ambiguous because, yep. and back to our bad actors and fraud issue, that's how some of that could even emerge. If you
right.
leave the ethics of your organization and what you're doing ambiguous because you don't want to tread those waters to anger some party.
People could be stealing from
exactly, you. Exactly. You leave yourself open to misinterpretation, and intentional or not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, so the way we close this podcast and is usually we ask our guests to give us a moment when they yes-anded.
Mm-hmm.
So is there something in your life, and it can be from any aspect of your life, where you didn't say no, you know, and you didn't just say yes. You, like, yes-anded. You went in and terror reigned or greatness prevailed or there was a moderately interesting thing that happened.
Yes. So I had thought about this in anticipation, and I don't know if mine is as bold. This is my problem. When
yeah.
I think of yes and, I try to think of when have I said something amazing? When have I done yes and it's changed my life? Or
right.
when I said yes to my husband? I mean, that's silly, right? The ones
Not
that
to
are
him.
Most... Yeah, well, true. Or me.
Yeah.
But the ones that are most meaningful to me are the moments that are mundane.
Right.
So I told my husband that this is the only story I could think of, and he said it was good. So I'm blaming him if it's not good.
Go for it.
So the one that stuck in my mind this week and that I couldn't get over was just something that happened last week. So I'm working with a team, and we were trying to solve a problem of research. So what research method or what research approach should we use on this module of the project? And I had thought of a paper I had just heard of, actually the Devin Pope paper
yeah.
that you and I saw a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I sent it to them. They got really excited and were going to present to me their ideas on how we could do something similar or inspired by that. And we had the meeting then when they showed me their angle on it, and it was so different. It was totally different than what I was expecting. And my first reaction was totally no but.
Yeah.
It was like, where did my idea go?
Mm-hmm.
This is not how I thought this meeting was going to go. And
mm-hmm.
I felt so childish, and it was a total no but.
Yeah.
Internally, and I'm sure it came out in my first few words. Asking them about it. It wasn't yes and validating them. And I actually felt ashamed in that moment and retroactively about it. It wasn't even about saying yes to the idea, but I didn't even validate
mm-hmm.
where they came from. Now, I know that's not saying yes and, but right after that, I had to go to the client and then present our ideas. And
yep.
in that, they were on the phone, I was with the client, and I yes and it all the way because having the improv training made me realize and honestly be ashamed. I know it sounds like a silly small meeting, but I felt so ashamed that my first reaction was, why is my idea not out here?
Right.
Why didn't they build on my idea? No, I don't want their idea. Even when they pointed out to me that my idea actually would add zero value.
Yeah.
And I knew that was right. My reaction was to no but. So my best effort to yes and it, like an hour later with the client, presenting their idea and the framework of it. I know that, again, that's not an uplifting.
No, it's awesome.
But I really want people to understand that it's not the big moments. It's the small ones that add up.
Indeed. And this is the point, too, which is we are going to no but continually. So do you throw the baby out with the bathwater? Do you be like, okay, well, I'm going to do that? I mean, it's like, no, life is hard,
yeah.
dudes. It's hard. And we make a lot of mistakes, and we are so imperfect. And you know, our brains aren't that great. So that when you do figure out a formula that mostly works, which is the yes and formula mostly works. It's a better way to collaborate, and it's a better way to treat fellow people, and it's a better way to find the best idea.
Right, and I think you need to yes and your no buts.
Yeah.
So I've had experiences, not that one, sadly, but had in that one, I started out with a no but, and then said, and I knew I was doing it.
Right.
If I had actually said, guys, I'm sorry, let's rewind, or basically yes-anding what I just did, making my mistake into a gift in a way to show honest humility and sincerity. I think it's just like in a scene where maybe I'm being a bad improviser, or maybe I said something I didn't mean to, but making that mistake into something bigger actually could have made that moment and that relationship a lot deeper.
Right.
Even though I started out with the quote-unquote wrong strategy.
Right. Look at your obstacles as gifts.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's the thing. Linnea Gandhi, thank you for joining us and getting to Yes And.
Thank you, Kelly.
All right, so here, I never know how to end these podcasts, and there could be music coming in now, so this, I don't even know if this is going to happen. So do you, like, should I drop a mic? What would you, do you have a recommendation? You're an improviser for ending. No.
Yes.
We're hitting a blank.
But, and we could just have a panoply of
words cascading down. Do it in post.
I just have improv quotes going through my head. Joy begets joy. Embrace the freak.
Love it. All this is good.
Don't be the a-hole.
Well, you can say out. No, you don't have to. We're on a podcast. You can say don't be
the asshole is a recurring meeting invite at 7 a.m. every day for me. Thank you, Susan Messing.
Love it. Yeah. All right. We'll end on that. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Hey, we'll see you all next week. This is Second City Works, getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.